Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow. It sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining, knowing you can always count on me. For sure, that's what friends are for.
I went to residential school, I was just 8 years old.
Gaela Kasla. My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlawitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to A Window, exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
This PSA was cut from a bigger documentary by Jesse Dubois from CJSW 90.9 FM in Calgary, Alberta.
Despite the Prairie Province's willingness to wear their history of settlement on their sleeves, I wasn't formally taught about residential schools until grade 12. This is particularly revealing as I myself am the son of an Indian residential school survivor.
Well, I attended residential school from 1956 to 1969. There was a four-year break in between, but altogether I was in there for 8 years. The desired outcome that the process was to take the Indianness out of me, so to speak, make me more, for lack of a better word, mainstream, whatever that was. Took away my language, took away my pride in what I was, what I am. So it was not a good experience. It took me away from family, which I think was probably the most damaging. I think it's taken a lifetime for me to deal with it, to accept it. It's been a struggle, but I survived. So.
All right, have a good one.
We're done?
Yeah, we're done. That's it. You can get up from your chair.
Oh, that was tough. You're a tough interviewer. Damn good questions. Hope I helped.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
All right, son.
All right, take care.
Love you, man.
Love you, too.
Okay.
You have just heard At Window, exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to their shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Hello and welcome to a new show which has no name. I'm Alistair Melling and I hope to be running a show pretty much every Monday from 5 till 6 discussing various things such as philosophy, politics, economics and a whole mix of those things together. The first piece I want to do is an interview I conducted maybe about a week ago with Scott Salnan, who is a computer engineer. This discussion was about Bitcoin. Scott is extremely knowledgeable in this matter, and it was a great pleasure to actually have him on the show. So I have a half an hour interview with this. I need to mention apparently that I'm on CITR. If you hadn't actually worked that out, so yes, this interview is very, very fascinating. All about Bitcoin. It's a very exciting new currency that's coming out. It's I would say an alternative currency or. as Scott likes to call it, a cryptocurrency. But I shall not blather on too much, if you actually know that phrase. Blather on. Basically means chat on. Too much. And, well, listen to the show. He is extraordinarily good at this. Excuse my unnecessary interruptions throughout the entire interview, but it's a very interesting interview indeed. And hopefully it'll play. Here
we go. Everyone asks, what is a Bitcoin when they first hear about it?
Exactly.
And the first thing I'll tell you is that it is a cryptocurrency, mm-hmm. and that it is basically the internet of money.
Mm-hmm.
So what it does is it allows you to have digital cash, I would like to call it, and you can send your digital cash over the internet to other people. And what's interesting about it is that it is based on the facts of cryptography, which allow it to be completely immune to certain kinds of attacks and certain kinds of hacks, if you want to call them that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like sending cash to someone without being a little concerned of who's watching and whether or not they can steal your money.
Mm-hmm. So let's just start off with the main differences before we get too technical. Too much technicality. The main difference between this currency and currency that we're already used to is, you would say,
the main difference.
What are the key differences?
The key difference is that there is no centralization to it.
Yeah.
It is completely decentralized. Your computer running your wallet, you're acting as a part of the network. You're basically acting as a confirmation source. You are the bank. You are your own bank. There is no one that, and in addition, this provides benefits because there's no transactions.
Costs.
There's nothing like that, right?
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that it gets the money out of the people who are printing the money.
Uh-huh. Yes, and that's true. I mean, and also there's no, I mean, the price of a Bitcoin, because there's something called mining Bitcoin.
Yes.
Now, I had no idea what this meant, but Scott is a miner himself.
Yes.
Do you want to explain a bit about mining? This is how they reproduce
so
money.
The thing about money, if you've taken anything related to economics or if you've heard about it, is that you need a source of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Bitcoin kind of comes into existence is, it's kind of called mining for a strange reason, is because the principles of it follow along what you would get out of gold. The more you dig for gold, the less exists.
Yes.
So Bitcoin actually follows the same principle. As time goes on, the production actually slows down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a deflationary currency in a way.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found very strange about it, because constantly, also there's no cost. Well, there's no, I mean, the actual cost of Bitcoin, producing a Bitcoin, is minute. It's like the electronical.
The cost of producing a Bitcoin would be electricity.
Electricity, rather than actual printing money. I mean, I think it's about 10%
correct.
Of current currency is in is in physical form,
mm-hmm.
and not
such as,
internet.
Well, we're getting rid of the penny here in Canada, so that's good news. But
actually,
producing something tangible,
uh-huh.
it's more like a credit card in that regard. Is that the money kind of is digital, and you don't really have to do anything else other than electrical.
And also, you could there's no the I think one of the beautiful things about this currency is that there is no you can take it to any country. Well, they're beginning to will. Later on discuss the kind of corporate institutions that are adopting Bitcoin, but there is no, you can take it from one country to the other without, you can transact, you can
correct
without any charges. There'll be
absolutely
no need
nothing.
If we actually adopt this, we no need for MasterCard, Visa, PayPal.
None of these will be required anymore.
Uh-huh.
Credit cards will be gone. One of the best things I like about it is that if you give your credit card information to someone, they can keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can charge your credit card. Yeah. If you give someone bitcoins, that's it. You just gave them equivalent to handing them like a $50 bill and you said goodbye. That was it. They don't have your information. You can withdraw your name. They may never know who you are. You just send them the money and they receive the money.
Mm-hmm. And explain a bit about the address system.
Address.
I said it like an American. Address systems. Address systems, yeah.
So basically when you create your wallet, you create a new wallet, and you have a public key and a private key. I'm not going to get too into details with how cryptography works, but the idea is that your private key is hidden, and the public key is what you can give to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So when people send you bitcoins, they send it to your public key. When you send someone else bitcoins, you send it with your private key.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you keep your computer secure and you don't let people know your passwords for your computer, then no one will ever get their hands on your private key. So only you can send your bitcoins. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of that is that as long as you have your computer with you, it doesn't matter where you are. As long as you're connected to the internet, you can move to France and you still have your bitcoins. You can send your bitcoins back to America. Someone in America can send bitcoins to you, and the internet is none the wiser of where it came from and where it went. Uh-huh.
And one of the cool things I think I found is, as long as I understood, we had a conversation last week. What I understand, understood from that was there's not the same basis as there is an account with
That's
your
correct.
Name. There's an address where the bitcoins can go to.
Exactly.
But you can recreate a bitcoin.
Making a new wallet is as simple as pressing another button. And you have a new bank account. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing tied to it.
So no need to go to the bank, no need to
exactly.
fill out some forms.
Nope, you don't have to pay a cent to create a new wallet. You uh-huh. create a new wallet and someone can say, oh, that was you mowed my lawn, here have 5 milli bitcoins for it. And then they pay you that and you say, oh, I just made a new wallet, put it in this one. You're done.
Mm-hmm. Oh, just to clarify for listeners who don't know anything about that, Bitcoin is now worth, it's jumping around.
It's about $1,000 Canadian per Bitcoin.
So when you said milli Bitcoin,
most of us call it milli Bitcoins because about 1 milli Bitcoin is about $1. So it makes more sense to say, oh yeah, here's like 20 bucks, here have 20 milli Bitcoins.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty cool how when we realized that the price was getting so high, it's like, oh, we should probably tell people that sending one Bitcoin to someone is kind of a big deal.
Big deal, yeah.
That's a lot of money.
That's what it was in days gone by. Mm-hmm. Sending, for my own currency, a pound. Mm-hmm. I think you could buy a house for, in my dad's, so that's the 70s, my dad could buy for a few thousand pounds.
Yep.
So same, probably.
Same thing happened with money. So you see your grandparents and you're like, oh, I just, here's 100 bucks. And they're like, what?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, wait a minute. Forgot about inflation.
Inflation, which is, and that's one thing that Bitcoin isn't necessarily subject to.
What's interesting about it is that a government can print as much money as they feel like. And they don't even have to, technically they have to tell you, but who's to say that they are?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, well, I'll not discuss that part. But the thing is about Bitcoins is that you can't change how much is going to be produced. I believe it's 21 million Bitcoins are going to ever be produced in Bitcoins.
It's finite.
That's finite. That's going to happen. The rate of production is a de-exponential logarithmic curve.
Yes.
But so the idea is that it slows down over time.
So it will never quite reach that.
Exactly.
How much did you say?
21 million, I believe, is the correct number. And it's 2140 is when the last Bitcoin is going to be produced.
2140.
So it's going to take a while to make all the Bitcoins in existence. So we're still going to be producing them for quite a while.
Okay.
And I hope by 2140 we've maybe made something better.
Yeah. I also wanted to point out is the fantastic thing about one another thing that's just, for me, I don't know.
Too many fantastic things.
Orgasming over this new currency is that a recent fact I discovered, Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, they take nearly 50% of the profits of supermarkets away when they mm-hmm. pay by card for their transaction fees, various things. So that's one of the reasons why if you go to No Frills, I don't know if any listeners have actually gone there. They don't accept. Obviously you would. All exchange students that I know go to No Frills because it's cheaper. And the reason why it's cheaper is because they really insist that you do not pay by any credit card. Mm-hmm. They do accept Visa debit, but I think that's the only card that they accept because
it's more of a debit.
Yeah,
it's more of a debit. But what's interesting is that if you actually disassemble how a credit card goes through, you pay a credit card company a transaction fee, and I think the you don't notice it very much, but the merchant does. It's like 5 to 10% of the entire transaction goes to the credit card company,
mm-hmm.
and then you go to the bank, and they charge the credit card companies a percent, and then you go to the government. So yeah. There's this entire thing of just the middleman just siphoning out the money, and when you go for Bitcoin, you don't actually have to pay any transaction fee.
Mm-hmm.
If you use an intermediate system for convenience, then you might pay a transaction fee. For that, something that would say sell the bitcoins on the market for you immediately and give you the value back, you might pay a transaction fee. But that's because they're providing a new service.
A new service.
But what's interesting is Coinbase is one of these, and they, for a merchant, if you're a new merchant to Coinbase, for the first $1 million of transactions, you don't pay any transaction fees.
First $1 million.
Wow.
All right, that's quite
You don't pay a cent of transaction fees.
That is.
And if you're getting that much money, if you're over $1 million, this is the thing about it. Instead of the merchant paying at least 5% for every transaction, that goes to direct profit for them.
Mm-hmm.
That is a big deal.
That is incredible deal. And also, one thing I wanted to cover when you mentioned the fact that government can continue printing money without... I mean, that's how...
And bank bailouts, too.
None of these bank bailouts, none of this national debt would be possible.
That's correct. Because you cannot make more bitcoins than you have.
Uh-huh. Exactly. And so... The reason, one of the huge problems that we've had in principally Europe and United States, Canada, is because we've been able to print the money and we've had some sort of dominance over the world. Because in order to make people still want your currency, it's either got to be attractive by intrinsically, which the dollar is not anymore. Well, it is because it's used, you are trading in... it's traded in almost everything. So oil specifically, but that was only because that fact in itself is enforced by the fact that I think it was in the 70s after the Yom Kippur War and the OPEC massively hiking up the price of oil.
It's essentially backed by something.
Yeah, exactly. And the Americans went to Saudi Arabia, Iran at the time, although the Shah was pretty much in their pocket around about early 70, 71. Went to the Bahrainian royal family, same with the Qatari one and United Arab Emirates, and they said to them, it's essentially, you guys trade in dollars, or and as compensation, we will make sure your monarchies stay in power. And any contention to that, actually, we've seen contention by Gaddafi, who wanted to trade, obviously, in 2010, I think it was. Or it was early 2011. Not exactly sure. But around that time, he was trying to say, he was trying to organize within OPEC to sell gold and to sell oil in a gold dinar. 2003, I think it was 2001 to 2002, 2003, Saddam was talking about adopting the euro to sell oil on within euros, which is why Europe jumped on immediately because our main trading partner is Europe, and if the price of the euro jumped, that would just would cause huge instability within the British economy. So we jumped on the back of Bush for other reasons, oil itself. So and that's how they've managed to keep the price of the dollar specifically very high, because they print it and they create this artificial demand through violent threats, through backing dictatorial regimes, many different reasons.
Basically, the control is with the government.
The control yes, exactly. That's
and
what I'm getting
what's
at.
Interesting about Bitcoin is that the control is with whoever is mining it. And the people who are mining it
are
me and you.
Yeah.
That's the thing. We have the control.
Uh-huh. Exactly, it's power to the people, in some sense. I mean, you're a minor person.
I am a minor, but I'm stop
a minor miner.
Yes, but the actual profit margins on mining now have actually come pretty close to electricity.
Are
so
you
a lot of people are actually stopping mining, and I am getting off the boat, unfortunately.
Oh, right.
So mining for decentralization purposes still exists, but mining for profit is actually pretty much done for. You really have to pay big dollars and buy big machines that are specifically built for building mining. But the thing is, the problem with getting these, it's still decentralized because everyone wants it, because there is profit to be made if you do spend the money.
Uh-huh.
But it's no longer too profitable for someone to mine on just any old computer.
I see. So the profit margin, you can explain a little bit about this. It's for every, you're talking about blocks.
Yes.
Now so explain a bit about blocks.
So basically, in order to prevent fraudulent activity, all transactions are recorded and put into a block. So when this block is mined, whoever is who has basically confirmed that all these transactions are in this block, they get the printed bitcoins, essentially. Mm-hmm. So they're basically the person at the bank that says, yes, this check was successfully deposited.
Instead of bouncing. So obviously, if you've got an electronic piece, you can send, to, I mean, like, a, you, it's like an image. You can send an image to one person, you can send an image to another.
And try to fraud someone. And the miner's going to say, okay, this one sent, and that was it. That was all the money you had.
Yeah.
Nothing else gets into the block. Uh-huh. Block is printed.
So they're the safeguard.
Yes, exactly.
And so how? So as you said before, it's the profitability of a single person
mining is really minimal.
It's really minimal. So what ensures people continuing to mine? It's these investing in machines.
It is because it's minimal. So you'd have to have a very large amount of it to make that minimal something bigger. So it's now sort of like you're mining it because you're confirming it. Mm-hmm. Rather than mining it for money.
Okay.
So there was a bit of a gold rush, I think.
At the beginning.
That's what I would call it, is when people realize that this is really valuable, so I'm going to start digging away. Uh-huh. And then nowadays, it's kind of like, okay, well, the gold is getting a little sparser now, so the people who are mining it they believe in the system, essentially.
Okay.
And they're getting paid a tiny reward for doing so.
Yeah, because it's now down to 25.
It's 25 bitcoins per block, and the blocks are shared to the mining pool, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so your personal mining profits, like for a day, I was down. I keep dropping and dropping and dropping. I can make maybe about $1 per day now. I mean, it's something.
$1 a day.
$1 a day, but that's one person mining.
And that requires how much effort on your part? So
I'm saying like $2. I make, and $1 goes to electricity.
Do you just run a computer program? Is that essentially it?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, so you don't actually physically, you just...
It's on a server is what we'd like to call it. Basically, just a computer box somewhere that has a bunch of hardware components in it that are doing the math.
Okay.
And so as Bitcoin evolved, people started producing hardware components specifically designed to mine Bitcoins, because mm-hmm. that's where the gold rush came in, right? People were selling you shovels.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to move on to obviously, we've covered the practicality of Bitcoin. It can be sent. As long as you've got access to the internet, you can send it.
Correct.
You just have it can even go onto an app onto your... Have they got an app yet?
They do, actually.
They do have an app.
But what's interesting is Apple doesn't like it.
Oh, of course it doesn't.
But there's a whole bunch of good ones for Android. And there's actually some very decent online ones as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that even though Apple doesn't like it, you can still open up Safari and send it over the internet.
Uh-huh. And any jailbroken...
Don't even have to be jailbroken. Just any device with access to the internet, like an Internet Explorer, even.
Oh, really?
No one uses Internet Explorer.
Or anyone else.
But any sort of device that can use the internet and use, like, Flash.
What I wanted to also discuss is what institutions are now taking on. So beyond the practicality of it, we have, I think, recently announced today, maybe I think it was today, that the University of Cumbria in England, University of Cumbria is my twin.
Is that the correct university? I can't remember which one came out.
It's Cumbria. Cumbria. I just realized those are the guys.
I remember reading this morning that there was a university that says you can now pay some of your tuition in Bitcoin, and we accept it.
I read over that, but I read Cumbria, but I didn't really fix it in that there are rival university. I go to Lancaster University, which is in North East.
Should send an email to university and say, hey,
what the fuck,
guys, get on the bandwagon, we're moving.
Exactly. So these guys are, they're just they're based a little bit north where we are, and they go to the same clubs as we do on Saturday. Always a bit of contention. So they're offering it for two courses, I believe, and they said, I think they said in specific specifically to people who want to play in Bitcoin, that they do not wish people to pay in Bitcoin, exchange into Bitcoin purely to pay the tuition fees. If you've got Bitcoin, they encourage it. But it's only for two courses. But early days.
The thing is, it's starting to get the name out and starting to get adoption ready.
Which is what we're trying to do.
Exactly. What the thing is, a lot of merchants are getting on board. It's kind of hard right now to get your hands on the Bitcoin. And that's because how do you make like real money?
Mm-hmm.
What I call it real money, fiat currency.
Fiat currency.
What a lot of people call it. How do you make that? Well, the job pays you. Mm-hmm. And right now, jobs aren't paying you in Bitcoin. So it's a little hard to get your hands on Bitcoin. You do have to go through an exchange. Mm-hmm. And they generally charge like 0.5% on transactions. So there is still some transaction fees when you're going through an exchange to get Bitcoin out of your fiat currency. Because, uh-huh. of course, you're buying it from someone else who has Bitcoin.
Yes. And also, the price of Bitcoin, as we discussed, it's about $1,000 right now.
It's skyrocketed in the last few months.
So
it started at the beginning of December. Yes, with the blip. It started at the beginning of December at around $250. And then at the end of December, it was around $700. Uh-huh. So it did skyrocket over 1,000 and then back down to under 1,000. And now we're kind of leveling off at 1,000.
And the reason for it, which
is interesting, is because
it's very interesting.
China started, was really buying into Bitcoin. And then the government cracked down on it and said, no, we're shutting down your exchanges. We're shutting down the way you can get Bitcoin.
Which I think is a brilliant sign because...
Which is interesting.
No, I think it's a brilliant sign because anytime a government tries to shut things down...
China is notorious for controlling. Uh-huh. And so when that happened, a few interesting things happened. All the Chinese basically took their money out of their exchanges immediately because they were afraid of them getting locked out. Mm-hmm. But after that happened... The local Bitcoin, which is like sort of in person paying for Bitcoins, mm-hmm. People were meeting up with each other and exchanging Bitcoins for cash. So that kind of increased after the drop. It's because even though the government was cracking down on it, they can't stop people meeting each other and changing. It's like if me giving you a piece of gold and you giving me some money, that was what it was.
Exactly.
And then after that, people realized that, okay, this crash isn't actually that big of a deal.
No, it's not.
And then the price started jumping right back up.
And one of the reasons is, I think, anytime the government tries to interfere with any market forces, so we can use the drugs war. I think this, mm-hmm. I heard this on Free Domain Radio, if you've heard of Free Domain Radio.
I have not.
A guy based in Toronto called Stephen Molyneux. I think it was on one of his shows that he was saying, basically, anytime the government tries to get involved, it ends up increasing the price.
Backfiring. Yes.
Always backfires. It ends up increasing the price. So with the war on drugs, he was saying in London during the 19... just after World War II, when you could go to a store and buy 3 shots of heroin for a matter of pence. It was less mm-hmm. than 10. It was like 8 pence or something, which in today's money is a few pounds. Or a few dollars. And then after they made that illegal, so in the, I think it was in the 80s, it skyrocketed by about, for one shot, it was £10, which was a lot. So anytime the government tries to interrupt with these market forces, it pushes the price up because people realize that they can make money from it, so they're going to supply it more. And so maybe that's not necessarily, it does discourage people from using drugs because the price is higher, but the price is then... But doesn't work the same way necessarily with a currency. When the price goes up, people realize they can invest in it mm-hmm. and make money off it. Exactly. You can't make money off drugs, while you can sell them.
In this situation, it kind of functions like a stock market.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, so you can buy and sell. And if the price is going up, and I think it's really interesting to see that the Chinese government, which is not the most enthusiastic towards human rights and freedom,
the most democratic.
No, not entirely. It's interesting to see that they are very negative towards this because...
They're concerned
because this puts a lot of power into...
People's hands.
Uh-huh. And it means that they can no longer... Well, if it would threaten their ability to manipulate their currency. Obviously, it's less so now because they've got more of a homegrown mm-hmm. Consumption or consumers. So they don't have to sell there. I don't know if anybody does economics, but you want a low price. If you're an exporting nation and you want your currency to be lower. So that's how they've been doing. Mm-hmm. They've been exporting massively over the past few decades because they've kept their prices low. And so therefore it's cheaper to import from China than actually produce it in your home nation.
In your home nation, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. So I think it's very interesting to see that China's not... it's almost panicking with this, which... means that it's working finally.
It is working, and that's the thing. A lot of the Chinese government is buying up US dollars, and mm-hmm. lately they've stopped, and I'm curious
they
to see.
They stopped? I thought
they're slowing down
because they did just
like China. They're buying less and less US bonds and treasuries and dollars.
They are. There was a brief blip down, but
I'm curious to see if they're going to start buying bitcoins because they almost see it as an American thing. when the reality is that a lot of it is offshores already, anyways, in Europe. I know Germany is a very big place for Bitcoins as well. And it's catching on in almost every place.
Yeah, and also there's no way to tax it at all.
Well,
is it?
You have to be honest to tax it. So if you're a merchant, then you obviously are already bookkeeping. So you put down the value in in dollars that you took. But giving someone your Bitcoins and them sending it to you, that's not taxable. Because, I mean, it's not, in reality, it's not a capital gain, right? Unless you're paying for a good or service.
Okay.
So you do have to, you have to be careful. Otherwise, IRS equivalent will come knocking. But basically, if you're honest with it, you, the feds don't have a problem. The governments don't have a problem with it, right?
Above a certain, is there a possibility of them coming in and regulating Bitcoin?
That's
well?
That is also an interesting discussion that hasn't been confirmed by North American governments. A lot of other governments are calling it a currency. Other governments are calling it like a good or service, like a Bitcoin as a thing, and not an actual currency. Which is interesting on the taxation laws for the like your local government. So if you're somewhere offshore, you're gonna have to check on the laws if you want to buy or sell in Bitcoins.
Okay, because well, certainly with the offshore, I think it's instead of people having to go offshore, doesn't this mean people who are storing their money offshores would actually make more sense for them to invest in put it in Bitcoin because it's they don't need to go to this, they don't need to invest it elsewhere.
Exactly,
they can just have it. Well, on the internet, it's not
exactly.
Just remember. Okay, so that definitely adds a different dimension.
But
so
if you're receiving income as a merchant,
okay,
then you're obviously have to report that to the government as an income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not really an issue as long if the company itself is honest, then they're gonna have no issue.
How would you recommend people to get involved?
What
can you do to? I hope we've convinced listeners to that Bitcoin
it's coming. What I recommend you do, not necessarily get your hands on Bitcoins.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the most important part. The most important part is to make sure that businesses know that they can accept this, and when more and more businesses are accepting it, then they can. Their employers might start asking for their first paychecks in Bitcoins.
Okay.
So get the word out there that it exists, it's possible, and that these merchants can reduce on transaction fees by doing this.
Massively.
And if you do want to buy Bitcoins, check out localbitcoins.com, I think it's CA Vertex for Canada, and you can easily buy Bitcoins.
I feel maybe the most important thing is...
There's actually an ATM. The first ATM in the world came out in Vancouver.
That's true. They were actually putting up.
So you can. It's a bit more of a transaction fee than buying it in person, of course.
Okay.
But you can actually go there and spend your
these
money.
These are like physical.
These
ATMs.
Are physical ATMs.
I did read about this.
Yes.
A while ago.
It's a box. It's an ATM. You put your card in, and you get Bitcoins out.
Wow, that's awesome. That's incredible.
And go support Bitcoins. Go if you have Bitcoins. Don't just hold on to them. Go spend them. Go find those merchants who are accepting Bitcoins and buy a cup of coffee there. And because then they see, oh, hey, it's working.
It's working. We can actually...
Yeah, we can actually make extra money off of this.
Uh-huh. Okay, fantastic. Well, lovely to have you here, Scott. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No problem. I'm very excited about this entire thing. So, thank you very much. I think I'll just cut it off at the end. So we can finish that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much to Scott Sandlin for that interview, even though it was long, extensive, and extremely technical. I hope you kept track of the whole entire thing. You are listening to CITR 101.9 with Alistair Milling on the show that has no name. I hope to add one for next week. This is, as I said, going to be a show that runs once a week from 5 till 6, discussing philosophy, politics, and economics, which is pretty much my degree. But it's something I'm very interested in. We have, after a couple of PSAs, we have Iqbal joining us, who would like to introduce himself now. Go for it.
Hi, this is Iqbal Ahmed, known from the CITR news team, and you might be a fan of my segment, Hardball with Iqbal.
I've heard many infamous things about that, but we shall be discussing pretty much professional sports. after the three PSAs we have coming up now, obviously prompted by the Super Bowl that occurred yesterday. If you missed that, if you managed to miss that, you have to put effort into it. So, yes, join us after there, and we will be discussing professional sports.
This is a journey into sound. Gotta have house
music. Hi, this is DJ Wah, inviting you to join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. here on 101.9 CITR for Techno Progressivo. You in my hug
now. My life. This is the house that funk built. This is the house that funk built.
Techno Progressivo is the only radio show in Vancouver where you'll hear the best mix of new tech house, techno, and progressive house.
A body thing.
So join me every second Sunday at 8 p.m. for Techno Progressivo.
House music. House music.
Astorino's is located off Commercial Drive in the heart of East Vancouver. It's run by the Britannia Community Center and is available to rent for anyone. Some of its features include tall ceilings, wood floors, accessible bathrooms, a stage, and a PA. Astorino's is an accessible space and centrally located. It's ideal for any type of rehearsal, information session, dance classes, arts and crafts sales, rummage sales, community events, and of course, shows and dancing.
Check out BritanniaCenter.org and the Facebook search Astorino's, or contact Maddie Harris by email at maddiefromlife@gmail.com to learn more.
Hello and welcome back to the show. I am once again joined by Mr. Iqbal Ahmed.
Hi.
From? Where are you from?
I was born in Pakistan. I moved to England when I was 2, then I moved to Winnipeg when I was 3, and then I moved to Vancouver. And then lived in Vancouver till I was 9. Then I moved to Alaska, and I spent most of my life in Alaska until I was 18. And then I
That's
came
a bit
back.
Of a come down.
Yeah, exactly. And then I came back to then I came back to Vancouver for university. So, yeah, that's my life story.
Fantastic. I like to get that in the first 20 seconds of our interview. So Iqbal has kindly last minute. I don't know if that even works. Joined me to discuss sports and the excessive amount of money that is spent on, well, we're going to focus on American football, or football as you like to shorten it incorrectly too. Sorry, I'm from the UK and we have a very large problem with it being called football when it's got nothing to do with it. But
the ball's a foot long.
It's
No, really.
Really? Is
like it? Back in the day, like that was like the...
Oh, right. Okay, so Iqbal is going to add lots of little facts into this. Mm-hmm. Fun facts.
I'm known for my fun facts, actually.
Okay, this is how you got your own show, I think, I'm guessing. Fantastic. So, the reason why I decided to discuss this mainly was it's been a pet peeve of mine for some time against professional sports. But it was recently prompted by the Super Bowl that obviously went on during yesterday, where Seahawks won 40 something eight. Completely.
38.
Yeah.
Destroyed Peyton Manning and the Broncos.
Okay. Which is of little concern to me because I am a big hater of professional sports. Not to just beat up on American football. It's all sports. I've come from a football, sorry, soccer, the S word, oh my goodness, background. Where I support Man United, and I began to sort of question about it amongst a bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. Like, why do I have to actually support this team just because my family does? Does it actually make any sense? So I went on down that road, and it led me to some miserable facts, such as...
discuss what you just said about why people support teams.
Why do people support teams? So I have a problem with this because I feel that the idea of supporting a team is some sort of... It ignites some sort of chauvinistic tribal instinct to support something because you've got some sort of affinity to it, but it doesn't actually give you anything.
But it's entertainment, right? At the end of the day, like, there's that, like, you must say, like, a tribal instinct to it.
Of course.
But at the end of the day, it's all just to have a good time and then leave. There's no.
But then 2,000 years ago, to have a good time, they went to something like a Colosseum and watch people eaten by lions.
And aren't you glad we've evolved from that, you know?
I hope to evolve a little bit more than just gagging down several gallons of beer and popcorn for 4 hours.
I think ideas of a good time differ, though.
Yeah, yeah. I hope we mature as human beings. But what I wanted to also kind of discuss, I'll just briefly go through some facts and then hear your opinion. Around about $10 billion is spent or is raised in revenues within the NFL. Mm-hmm. About 1.5, so nearly 20%, so 15%. There we go. It's quite an easy number. Is funded actually by the taxpayer. A lot of, I think it's
of
about
the revenue.
Of the revenue. So yeah, so that, so oh, but it's yeah, of the revenue. So 1.5. So they actually, without that, they would be making
15 less, I see.
Yeah, exactly. About 32 stadiums in the US pay no property taxes. I think you were alluding to something slightly before then with
Madison Square Garden, yeah.
Oh, okay, Madison Square Garden, where they pay no taxes whatsoever because of some sort of
clerical error.
I think something like they paid, to give you some facts about the way in which the government, the stadiums are funded. I think back in this, it was 1976, the Minnesota, I think it was the, no, it was in Jersey, New Jersey. They funded they built a stadium and then demolished it a few years ago. But to pay for the stadium, they raised it in bonds, which is obviously government debt. Yeah. They're still paying around about $35 million a year in tax. Well, it's going directly to that to pay off the debt for a stadium that was built and is not used anymore. It's completely being raised to the ground.
Could you say that's the result of mismanagement versus the sport itself? When you look at, okay. I mean, for whatever example you can put, there can be a counter example, right?
Of course.
So if you look at a stadium that's very much helped the city, look at Detroit, right, where the Detroit Lions play. And then they also have Joe Louis Arena that has Detroit's basketball team's not coming to my mind, but the Detroit Red Wings play there.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a bigger hockey fan, so that's one thing I can talk more about. But
And
in Detroit, it actually brings a lot. It's a big boon for the city of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Because Detroit's problem is, as you might be well aware, that everyone lives in the suburbs.
Okay.
And, I mean, part of Detroit, like, manufacturing for a lot of reasons, but one of the big reasons why Detroit's in the states it's in, because Detroit wasn't allowed to expand like other cities was. Mm-hmm. Other cities were, right? You know, like,
okay.
Vancouver gets bigger, then the Vancouver metro area, quote unquote, becomes bigger, then people start paying taxes for that infrastructure.
Okay.
You know, cities grow and they swallow up. I mean, look at London. Mm-hmm. London just gets bigger and bigger and bigger and just swallows up these little towns around it that become London. Toronto's had an expansion recently. Detroit wasn't allowed to expand. There was actually a lawsuit, I believe, that made it that some town, there's like a line. If you look at a map of Detroit, it's kind of a straight line where it ends.
Mm-hmm.
And so Detroit wasn't allowed to expand and get that tax base, even though when you're looking in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, there was like a flight of people into suburbs. So everyone wants to live in suburbs now and then commute in, then go to work. So people are using the Detroit's infrastructure, but they're not living in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the stadium does is it brings those people back into Detroit to spend money, right? So money that is usually circulating outside of Detroit comes in, because when people come to watch a Red Wings game, right, they're going to pay at least like $90 a ticket mm-hmm. per person. They're going to buy gas, probably eat in a restaurant there. And the entire day will be set in a city that they would not be in otherwise.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right? So if you can say that because you have such attractions,
mm-hmm.
and sports is a regionally based kind of identity, like you were saying, the tribalism is geographically focused.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you're doing is you're bringing capital in, but people wouldn't be there otherwise.
So, yeah, you're kind of alluding to what I kind of wanted to get to, in ancient Roman times, sport, went to the games to watch people getting murdered and eaten by lions. This played some sort of role because it kept the people distracted. That was the social role that it had. So whenever there was discontent going on in the cities, they used the games to distract the people.
But could you also say that people were drawn to sports to be entertained in times of great depressions?
Yes, it's a distraction.
But you're saying it's kind of an artificial distraction. Like the way you're phrasing it, it's saying that sports were established by like some sort of power to distract people from the true problems.
Well, if you want to look at it that way, I would definitely reinforce that. So you've got Monday night football, is it Tuesday, baseball, Wednesday, hockey, football.
Hockey's on every night.
You've got a sport on every. You can sit down and watch the TV and never know anything about the rest of the world. I mean, we don't have this in quite the same extent in Europe, but still, if there's some crisis going on, what they'll do, the Champions League on, everyone for a week must pay attention to this.
So you're saying they time the Champions League so that when things are going on in like Kiev and Ukraine, they show like the Manchester Derby is going to be on at that time every year? Like
Not that time, but it's not. Okay, that's a specific example, but I find that sports are just used as a distraction. But I do understand...
Wait, by who though?
Ooh, it's very difficult to say by a specific group of people.
So you're saying there's some sort of like giant cultural like construction that puts sports on us to make us like deaf, dumb, and blind to what's going on in the real world?
No, I don't allude to any conspiracy. Okay. It's just general, ignorance on the part of most people. So they're more riled up. In general, the people who are putting this on the TV, not just the people who are receiving it, people on the TV, they're far more interested. They're in their own little world, and they're far more interested in what's going on with Ronaldo, or I don't actually follow any North American.
Yeah.
That I couldn't care
about. LeBron
less.
James.
Yeah, okay, we can go to LeBron. I do actually know that. Yeah. They're far more interested in what's going on with these people than actual real
issues. And that's
issues.
A choice. But people do that with celebrities.
Choice, you can say
so,
choice.
Wait,
but
people do that with celebrities,
exactly.
With movie celebrities.
Okay.
So are you saying that the movie industry, which is, you know, often touted as like great art, whatever, I mean, as a side to it, right? And so that the movie industry is also like to blame for this kind of negligence of what's going on in the real world. Should we have the same attitude towards movies? Should we, so in Vancouver gives tax breaks to lure industries, to movies to come to Vancouver to shoot, and gives them a lot of, like, you could say, political capital behind this, like, initiatives to bring these movies up there. We shouldn't be doing that either.
Well, I've got no personal investment in Vancouver, as I'm away in a few months.
I'm giving an example.
I don't think...
So is Hollywood.
Within my city, no, I don't think the government should be spending any taxpayers' money on those kind of things. This is the thing where we can actually make a difference.
But these are economic multipliers, is the thing.
I'm always dubious about... We can get into economic...
Think about it, like, when... My example earlier with Detroit, right? Mm-hmm. It's a way to foster economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
Like a city would rather have a sports team than not have a sports team.
Uh-huh.
Right? Look at Kansas City when they got who did Kansas City get? When they got that basketball team recently.
Okay.
Like they were so excited about that.
But see, this is something that we don't have in Europe. We don't have this concept of teams being able to move around. So we don't have this... teams can't hold their local government to ransom by saying, you know what, we're actually going to go, we're going
to
bugger off.
But they don't hold them to ransom.
They hold them to ransom by saying, if you don't give us this tax break or this funding, then we'll go somewhere else.
I don't think that's ever happened.
It has. It hasn't happened.
Teams have left in North America when they go bankrupt.
I think the last one was 1997, 1998, but I'm not entirely sure. But they've been threatening it ever since because they have that power over it. In Europe, the people, I actually slightly prefer the system, not that I... like the system, but I prefer it to the one that I see here, is that it's much more community-based. So if a company is going particularly bad or a team's particularly lacking, then the community sort of comes together and creates a pool.
When does it happen in Europe? I mean, when I think of in the last decade, teams that I can think of, my knowledge of the Premier League is like really scarce.
Okay.
But it's always been some big foreign investor coming in and just dumping money in.
Okay. I'm talking about the lesser league teams. The ones that,
In the relegated leagues, right?
Yeah.
But they only come up when they actually have the... Like, you can't just go from a lower league to a higher league, especially into the Premier League, because you need this level of infrastructure to even be accepted into it.
Exactly. But do we need this massive amount of sport, like, where you can...
It's an industry, man. Industries make people money.
They make, but it doesn't contribute anything to society. I can think of 1,000 better ways myself.
How does mining contribute to society?
To what?
Mining.
Mining?
Yeah.
Mining creates wealth. I'm talking about in that term.
Sports create wealth.
No, it doesn't actually create wealth. It just reallocates the money. Doesn't create anything. Mining your okay.
Okay, mining might be bad. I mean,
the
tech industry.
The tech industry.
Yeah. Something like.
That's technology which makes things more efficient.
No, I don't mean something like that. I mean something like social media industry, right?
Mm-hmm. That brings people closer together. There you've got me.
Right. So they're not making a product. They're moving wealth around. I mean, moving and just saying moving wealth around is like,
mm-hmm.
a pretty...
Well, it doesn't...
I'd say that wouldn't be true, because what you're doing is taking capital and you're turning it into individual wealth, right? You're taking assets and turning it into wealth, into people's wealth.
But it's not multiplying anything, as in you're just going in and you're spending the stadium.
There's a strong, like, you get Keynesian economics to have a real argument about this, or whether, like...
Oh, I'm not a big on Keynes. Yeah, I do economics.
Whether anything creates wealth, right? Look, does a movie industry cause economic activity? Would that create wealth?
Okay, everything...
And look at it this way. When you have a sports team, that creates a demand for more products. Mm-hmm. That's economic stimulus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if mining creates wealth and sports doesn't, in some way, mining making more sports will make increased demand for steel, and then you get ore, you make wealth.
But
it is economic activity, and you can't say it's not. You can't say just moving money around.
Okay, I can discuss this for a while, but the last point I want to finish, because I think there's a guy trying to come in. Sure. So we'll spend the last 2 minutes on this. Does it require... Okay, we can argue many different ways in how it benefits society. Uh-huh. Da, 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 da. Does it require all this? So 15% in the US on the NFL. I'm not entirely sure what it's like in the UK.
If you asked...
Does it require government public funds?
If you asked the New York City Council tomorrow, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think having a sports team here is good for the city?
Yeah.
They'd say yes.
Of course, that's why it's self-perpetuating. If it wasn't, then this wouldn't be happening.
Exactly.
It's come from something. It doesn't really occur that much in the UK or in Europe, because we haven't got the same
But I think there's a competition from different cities trying to lure in sports teams.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what causes this to happen. Because cities know that, they believe in their own calculations. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, with this investment that they make, they're going to come out on top.
Actually, here's a quick one.
That's what they believe in, whether that's true or not.
The people who, I mentioned before in Jersey, they're still paying $35 million. They're at the $35 million a year to fund this stadium that doesn't exist anymore.
They
were already $1 billion in debt.
And that's mismanagement. Look at Seattle.
It's mismanagement, yeah.
Right? Seattle's a counterexample is a guy who's fronting to put up a stadium in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he needs to be some sort of government putting in money, but the vast majority is just one guy who wants to bring a basketball team back to Seattle.
Okay. Well, this discussion
can go on. One last thing, just a parting statement. A good sports quote when it comes to this is, sports is to war as masturbation is to sex.
It's just a warm-up.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you very much, Paul,
welcome.
For joining us, even though he had some sort of assignment paper to go on. I will hopefully be joining you next week with a few more controversial subjects to talk about. So this has been Alistair Melling with the show with no name. Hopefully it will have found its name by next week. You'll obviously listen to CITR 101, and I'm leaving you a PSA called Flex Your Head. Well, you can try to. See you later next week. Ciao.
Well, the hardcore stuff is just fast, very aggressive and loud, music, angry music.
I am your host, Mr. Steeston Mike. Welcome to the Flex Your Head Show on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. I'm here every Tuesday.
6 to 8 p.m.
Playing some punk and hardcore for you. If you want to hear something, feel free to give me a call at 604-822-2487 or swing by flexyourhead.net and send us an email with a request.
Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.